Penny said, "Luckily, the way we come out is as good as any. You can about see where we come." The walk that had seemed so long was as nothing on the Foresters' horses. The Baxters remembered that they hadn't eaten since breakfast. They fished in their knapsacks and munched on Nellie Jinwright's bread and meat. Penny, in his lightheartedness, fell into the spirit of the Foresters' drunkenness. He shouted back, "Spent the night with an old gal of mine." They whooped noisily in applause. "Only she wasn't there." They whooped again. Jody, at leisure, remembered the jovial air of Nellie Jinwright. He said to Millwheel's back, "Millwheel, if my ma had been somebody else, would I be me, or would I be somebody else too?" Millwheel shouted ahead, "Hey, Jody wants a new ma." He thumped on Millwheel's back.
"I don't either. I just want to know."
The question was beyond Millwheel, sober. It was only a source of ribald comment, drunk. Penny said, "Now, just past that stretch of low hammock, there's our bear." They dismounted. Lem spat in disgust. "You lucky son of a preacher." "Every man could have come up with him that was willing to stay with him," Penny said, "or got mad enough, the way I'd done to foller." There was disagreement as to how to cut up the meat. Buck wanted to take it in whole for effect. Penny struggled to convince him of the impossibility. They talked him at last into agreeing to quarter it, as was usually done with a bear of so great a size. Each dressed quarter would weigh 100 pounds. They skinned and quartered it. The hide was left intact, with the great head and clawed feet. Buck said, "I got to have it that-a-way. I got an ID for some fun." They had a round of drinks from their bottles. They set back for the road with a bear quarter over each of 4 horses and the hide over a 5th. It needed a family as big as the Foresters to provide transportation for old Slewfoot and both Baxters, too. The procession was boisterous. They shouted back and forth to one another. They reached Baxter's Island after dark. The house was barred and shuttered. There was no light, no curl of smoke from the chimney. Ma Baxter had gone on to the river with the horse and wagon. Flag was not about. The Foresters dismounted and drank again and called for water. Penny suggested cooking supper, but their minds were fixed on Volusia. They hung the bear meat in the smokehouse. Buck clung stubbornly to the hide. Jody found it strange to go around his own closed house in the dark, as though other people lived there and not the Baxters. He went to the back and called, "Flag! Here, feller!" There was no answering thump of small sharp hooves. He called again, fearfully. He turned back to the road. Flag came galloping to him from the forest. Jody clutched him so hard that he broke loose in impatience. The Foresters were shouting to him to hurry. He longed to have Flag follow along with him, but he couldn't endure it if he should run away again. He led him into the shed and tied him safely and barred the door against marauders. He ran back and opened it and spread out the meal he had been carrying for him in his knapsack. The Foresters thundered at him. He barred the door again and ran and climbed up behind Millwheel with a full heart. He could depend on Flag to come home to him. When the Foresters burst into harsh-voiced song like a flock of crows strung out along a fence row, he sang with them. Buck sang, "I went to see my Susan. She met me at the door. She told me that I needn't to come to see her any more." Millwheel called, "Whoopee!" "How about it, Lamb?" Buck went on. "She'd fallen in love with Rufus of Andrew Jackson fame. I looked her in the face and said goodbye, Miss Susan Jane." "Whoopee!" Gabby sang a plaintive lament of matrimony, each stanza ending with a refrain,
I married another, the devil's grandmother. I wish I was single again.
The scrub echoed with their shouting. They reached the river at 9 o'clock and bellowed for the ferry. Across the river, they rode on to the church. It was lighted. Horses and wagons and oxen and carts were tethered to the trees in the yard. Penny said,
Now, we're all right rough looking for church doings. How about Jody going in and fetching us out rations?
But the foresters had passed beyond persuasion or interference. Buck said,
Now you all help me get fixed. I'm aiming to scare the devil right out in that church building.
Lem and Millwheel draped the bearskin over him. He got down on all fours. He couldn't get an effect realistic enough to suit him, for the hide split down the belly allowed the great heavy head to slide forward. Penny was impatient to be inside and to reassure Ma Baxter, but the foresters were in no hurry. They donated 2 or 3 pairs of boot laces and laced the hide together across Buck's chest. The result was all he could ask for. His bulky back and shoulders filled out the hide almost as completely as the original owner. He gave a trial growl. They crept up the steps of the church. Lem swung the door open to let Buck pass inside, then pulled it back, leaving a crack wide enough for the rest to watch through. It was a moment or two before the visitor was noticed. Buck swayed forward with so true an imitation of a bear's rolling gait that Jody felt the hair crawl on the back of his neck. Buck growled. The assembled company turned. Buck halted. There was an instant of paralysis, then the church emptied through the windows as though a gale of wind had blown a pile of oak leaves. The foresters entered through the door, bellowing with laughter. Penny and Jody followed. Suddenly, Penny leaped for Buck and pulled the bear's head away so that the human face was exposed.
Get out in that thing, Buck. You want to get killed?
His eye had caught the glint of a gun barrel at one of the windows. Buck stood up and the hide slipped to the floor. The frolickers crowded in again. Outside, a woman screaming couldn't be quieted, and 2 or 3 children wailed in fear. The first reaction of the gathering was one of anger. One man called,
This be a purty way to come celebratin' Christmas Eve, scaring young'uns out in their wits.
But the holiday spirit was strong, and the drunken joviality of the foresters was infectious. Interest centered in the great bear hide. Here and there a man guffawed, and at last the crowd was laughing and agreeing that Buck had looked more like a bear than old Slewfoot himself. The big bear had done damage for several years. His reputation was known to all. Penny was surrounded by most of the men and boys. His wife greeted him and bustled away to bring him a plate of food. He sat on the edge of one of the church benches, pushed back against the plain bare walls, and tried to eat. He swallowed a few mouthfuls, then the men's eager questions enmeshed him, and he was away on the flowing stream of his tale of the hunt. The food sat in his lap uneaten. Jody looked shyly about in the unaccustomed color and brightness. The small church was decorated with holly and mistletoe and donations of house plants, sultanas and geraniums, aspidistras and coleas. Kerosene lamps shone from brackets along the walls. The ceiling was half hidden with suspended ropes of colored paper, green and red and yellow. At the front, where the rostrum stood for services, a Christmas tree was hung with tinsel and strings of popcorn, figures cut from paper, and a few shining balls that had been a present from the captain of the Mary Draper. Gifts had been exchanged and the wrappings were strewn under the tree. Little girls moved trance-like with new rag dolls clutched to their flat gingham breasts. The boys, too young to be engrossed with Penny, played on the floor. The food was on long plank tables near the Christmas tree. Grandma Hutto and his mother bore down on him to lead him to it. He found that glory hung about him, too, in a sweet aroma. Women crowded around him and pressed food on him. They, too, asked questions about the hunt. At first he was struck dumb and couldn't answer. He felt hot and cold and spilled salad from the plate in one hand. The other hand held three varieties of cake. Grandma Hutto said, "Now leave him be." He was suddenly afraid he wouldn't have a chance to answer the questions and would miss the shining triumph of the hour. He said quickly,
"We followed him near about 3 days. We jumped him twice. We got into mud Pa said would bog a buzzard's shadow, and we wrangled out of it."
They listened with flattering attention. He was filled with enthusiasm. He began at the beginning and tried to tell it as he thought Penny would do. Halfway through, he looked down at the cake. He lost interest in the account.
"Then Pa shot him," he ended abruptly.
He crammed a chunk of pound cake in his mouth. The clustered women turned to bring him more sweets. Ma Baxter said,
"Now you begin on cake, you'll not be able to hold nothing else."
"I don't want nothing else."
Grandma Hutto said,
"Leave him be, Ori. He can eat cornbread the rest of the year."
"I'll eat it tomorrow," he promised. "I know you got to have cornbread to grow on."
He went from one kind of cake to another and back again. He asked,
"Ma, did Flag come in before you left?" "He come in yesterday at dark. I declare it worried me, him coming in without you. Then Nellie Jinwright was here a while tonight and reported you."
He looked at her with approval. She was really handsome, he thought, in the black alpaca. Her gray hair was combed smoothly and her cheeks were flushed with a contentment and her pride. The other women addressed her respectfully. It was a great thing, he thought, to be kin to Penny Baxter. He said,
"I got something purty for you home."
"Have? 'Twouldn't be red and shiny, would it?"
"You found it."
"I got to clean house now and again.
You like it?"
"Purty as can be. I'd have wore it, but I figured you want to give it to me." "You want to know what I got hid for you or no?
Tell me."
"I got a sack of peppermint candy, and your pa made you a deer leg scabbard for the knife Oliver give you, and he made a buckskin collar for your fawn."
"How'd he do it without me knowing?"
"When you're once it asleep, he could put a new roof over you and you'd not know it."
He sighed with repletion of soul and body. He looked at the remnants of cake in his hands. He thrust them at his mother.
"I don't like it," he said.
"About time."
He looked about at the company and was again stabbed with shyness. Eulalie Boyles was doing a hop, skip, and jump in a corner with the wordless boy who sometimes ran the ferry. Jody stared from a distance. He would scarcely have known her. She had on a white dress with blue ruffles and blue bows of ribbon swung at the ends of her pigtails. He was swept with resentment, not of her, but of the fairy boy. Eulalie, in a remote fashion, belonged to him, Jody, to do with as he pleased, if only to throw potatoes at her. The Foresters had formed a group of their own at the end of the church near the door. The bolder of the women had taken them plates of food. To look twice at a Forester was to invite scandal. The more roistering of the men were with them, and the bottles were going around again. The Forester voices boomed above the hum of the festivities. The fiddlers went outside and brought in their instruments and began to tune and scrape. A square dance was formed and called. Buck and Millwheel and Gabby induced giggling girls to be their partners. Lem frowned from the outskirts. The Foresters made a violent and noisy affair of the dance. Grandma Hutto retired to a far bench. Her black eyes snapped.
"You'd never have got me here did I know them black devils was coming."
"Nor me," Ma Baxter said.
They sat stonily side by side, for once in agreement and harmony. Jody was half drunk himself with the noise and music, the cake and the excitement. The outside world was cold, but the inside of the church was hot and stuffy with the roaring wood stove and the heat of the packed and sweating bodies. A man, a newcomer, entered the door. A cold gust of air followed him so that everyone looked up to see what had brought it. A few noticed that Lem Forester spoke to him, and the man answered. and Lem said something to his brothers. In a moment, the foresters went out together. The group around Penny had been filled and satisfied with his story of the hunt and was now supplementing it with tales of their own. The square dance continued with a reduced number. Some of the women went to the group of hunters, protesting their absorption. The newcomer was brought to the still-loaded tables for food. He was a traveler who had disembarked from a steamer that had stopped for wood at the river landing. He said,
"I was telling the men, ladies, there was other passengers got off here. I reckon you know him, Mr. Oliver Hutto and a young lady."
Grandma Hutto stood up.
"You sure that name?"
"Why, yes, ma'am. He said his home was here."
Penny was pushing his way toward her. He took her aside. He said,
"I see you've done had the news. I'm feared the foresters gone to your house. I'm fixing to go there to try to ward off trouble. You want to go? Could be. They'd behave themselves better. Was you there to shame them?"
She bustled about for her shawl and bonnet. Ma Baxter said,
"Now I'll just go with you. I'd as soon give them varmints a piece of my own mind."
Jody trailed behind them. They piled in the Baxter wagon and turned back toward the river. The sky was strangely bright. Penny said,
"Must be a woods fire somewheres."
"Oh, my God." The position of the fire was unmistakable. Around the bend of the road, down the lane of oleanders, flames were shooting high into the air. Grandma Hutto's house was burning. They turned into the yard. The house was a bonfire. The flames showed details of the rooms within. Fluff ran to them, his tail between his legs. They jumped down from the wagon. Grandma called,
"Oliver! Oliver!"
It was impossible to approach within yards. Grandma ran toward the blaze. Penny pulled her back. He shouted above the roaring and crackling,
"You want to get burnt to death?
Oliver's there! Oliver! Oliver!"
"He can't be. He'd have got out."
"They've shot him. He's in there. Oliver!"
He struggled with her. In the bright light, the earth was plain. It was cut and trampled with the hooves of horses. But the foresters and their mounts were gone. Ma Baxter said,
"There's just nothing them black buzzards won't do."
Grandma Hutto fought to break free. Penny said, "Jody, for the Lord's sake, drive back to Boyle's store and see can you find somebody see where Oliver headed when he left the boat. If there's nobody there, go on to the doings and find out from the stranger." Jody clambered to the wagon seat and turned Caesar back up the lane. His hands seemed wooden and he fumbled with the reins. He was panicked and couldn't remember whether his father had told him to go first to the doings or first to the store. If Oliver was alive, he would never be unfaithful to him, even in his mind again. He turned into the road. The winter night was bright with stars. Caesar snorted. A man and a woman were walking down the road toward the river. He heard the man laugh. He cried,
"Oliver!"
and jumped from the moving wagon. Oliver called,
"Now look who's driving around by hisself. Hey, Jody!"
The woman was Twink Weatherby. Jody said,
"Get in the wagon quick, Oliver."
"What's the hurry? Where's your manners? Speak to the lady."
"Oliver, Grandma's house is afire. The foresters done it."
Oliver tossed his bags into the wagon. He lifted Twink and swung her to the seat, then vaulted the wheel and took the reins. Jody scrambled up beside him. Oliver groped with one hand inside his shirt and laid his revolver on the seat.
"The foresters is gone," Jody said.
Oliver whipped the horse to a trot and turned down the lane. The frame of the house stood revealed around the flames, as though a box enclosed them. Oliver caught his breath.
"Ma wasn't in it. She's yonder."
Oliver stopped the wagon and they climbed down. He called,
"Ma!"
Grandma threw her arms in the air and ran to her son. He said,
"Easy there, old lady. Quit trembling now. Easy."
Penny joined them. He said,
"No man's voice was never more welcome, Oliver."
Oliver pushed Grandma aside and stared at the house. The roof crashed, and a fresh blaze leaped to the moss in the live oaks. He said,
Which way is the Foresters gone? Jody heard Grandma murmur, "Oh, God." She braced herself. She said loudly,
"Now what in tarnation you want of the Foresters?"
Oliver wheeled. Jody said they done it.
"Jody, you fool youngin. The ideas a boy'll get. I left a lamp burning by a open window. The curtain must have blowed and catched. It worried me all through the evening at the doings. Jody, you must want a ruckus mighty bad."
Jody gaped at her. His mother's mouth was open. Ma Baxter said,
"Why, you know."
Jody saw his father grip her arm. Penny said,
"Yes, son. You got no business thinking such things of innocent men as miles away."
Oliver let out his breath slowly. He said,
"I'm sure proud 'twasn't their doing. I'd not have left one alive."
He turned and drew Twink close to him. "Folks, meet my wife." Grandma Hutto wavered, then walked to the girl and kissed her cheek.
"Now I'm glad you got it settled," she said. "Maybe Oliver'll take time to visit with me now and again."
Oliver took Twink by the hand and went to circle the house. Grandma turned fiercely on the Baxters.
"If you dast to let it out, you think I aim to have two counties strode with Forester blood and my boy's bones for a burned-up house?"
Penny laid his hands on her shoulders.
"Old lady," he said, "old lady, did I have the sense you got?"
She was quivering. Penny held her and she quieted. Oliver and Twink returned. Oliver said,
"Don't take it too hard, Ma. We'll build you the best house on the river."
She gathered her strength.
"I don't want it. I'm too old. I want to live in Boston."
Jody looked at his father. Penny's face was drawn. She said defiantly,
"I want to go in the morning."
Oliver said,
"Why, Ma, leave here?"
His face brightened. He said slowly,
"I always ship out of Boston.
Ma, I'd love it.
But do I turn you loose amongst them Yankees, I'm feared you'll start another war between the states."
Chapter 27. The Baxters stood at the river landing in the cold dawn, saying goodbye to Grandma and Oliver and Twink and Fluff. Around the bend to the south, the northbound steamboat whistled for the landing. Grandma and Ma Baxter embraced. Grandma caught Jody to her and held him tight.
"You learned to write, so you can write to Grandma in Boston."
Oliver shook hands with Penny. Penny said,
"Jody and me'll miss you fearful."
Oliver put out his hand to Jody.
"I thank you for sticking by me," he said. "I'll not forget you. Not even in the China Sea."
Grandma's chin was a flint arrowhead. Her mouth was tight. Penny said,
"If you folks ever change your minds and want to come back, there's a welcome at the island day or night."
The steamboat rounded the bend and warped into the landing. It carried a few lights, for the river between its banks was still dark. Twink said,
"We about to forget what we got for Jody."
Oliver fished in his pocket and handed her a round parcel. She said,
"This is for you, Jody, 'cause you helped fight for Oliver."
He was numb with the happenings of the day. He took it and stared stupidly. She leaned forward and kissed him on the forehead. Her touch was strangely agreeable. Her lips were soft, and her yellow hair was fragrant. The gangplank was thrown down. A bundle of freight was tossed to the dock. Grandma stooped and gathered Fluff in her arms. Penny took her soft, wrinkled face between his hands and laid his cheek against hers. He said,
"I got a real love for you.
His voice broke. The Hutto's filed up the gangplank.
The paddle wheels thrashed the water. The current sucked at the boat. It swung out into midstream. Grandma and Oliver stood at the rail and waved to them. The boat whistle blew again, and the steamer moved down the river. Jody stirred in his numbness and waved violently.
Goodbye, Grandma. Goodbye, Oliver. Goodbye, Twink. Goodbye, Jody.
Their voices trailed away. It seemed to Jody that they were moving away from him into another world. It was as though he saw them die. There were rosy streaks across the east, but the daylight seemed even colder than the night had been. The ashes of the Hutto house glowed faintly. The Baxters drove home toward the scrub. Penny was racked with sorrow for his friends. His face was strained. Jody was swept with so contradictory a tumult of thoughts that he gave up trying to sort them and snuggled down on the wagon seat between the warmth of his mother and father. He opened the package Twink had given him. It was a small pewter canister for his gunpowder. He hugged it to him. He remembered that Easy Ozell was on the East Coast and wondered if he would follow Grandma Hutto to Boston when he found her gone. The wagon jogged on to the clearing. The day would be cold, but brilliant. Ma Baxter said,
"Now, if 'twas me, I'd not have left without having the law on them baboons."
Penny said, "Nobody couldn't prove a thing. Them horse tracks? Why, the foresters would only say they'd seed the fire and come to watch it. They could say the county was full of horses, and 'twasn't even them had been there."
"Then I'd have let Oliver know the truth."
"Yes, and what'd he have done then? Lit in and killed 2-3 of 'em. Oliver's hot-headed, and why wouldn't he be? Most every man would take out after fellers did sich as that to him. All right, kill him a few foresters and maybe hang for it. Or else have the rest of 'em pitch in and kill the bunch of 'em. Him and his ma and his purty little wife."
"Purty little wife," she snorted. "Chipperdale."
Jody felt a new loyalty surge up in him.
"She do be mighty purty, ma," he said.
"Men is all alike," she said conclusively.
Baxter's Island was at hand. A sense of safety, of well-being came over Jody. Other people had catastrophe, but the clearing was beyond it. The cabin waited for him, and the smokehouse full of good meat, with old Slewfoot's carcass added to it, and Flag. Above all, Flag. He could scarcely contain himself until he reached the shed. He had a tale to tell him.
Chapter 28. The January weather was mild. Now and then the sun would set in a cold red stillness, quilts would be inadequate through the night, and morning would show a thin film of ice on the water buckets. Then, in a day or two, it would be so warm that Ma Baxter would sit on the porch in the sun in the afternoon and work at her mending and patching, and Jody could run through the woods without his wool jacket. The Baxter life had quieted along with the weather. The river folk were no doubt in a swivet, Penny said, over the burning of the Hutto house and the migration of the sharp-tongued mother, never understood, the sailor son, almost like a foreigner, and their own golden-headed Twink. Belief must be general that the drunken foresters had set fire to the place on receipt of the word that Oliver had returned with the girl. But the river was a long way off. The news filtered slowly to Baxter's Island. Penny and Ma and Jody sat by the hearth fire evening after evening, reliving the night through which they had stood with the Huttos and watched the house char into embers, had waited with them, warmed by its heat, for the morning boat that nothing could dissuade Grandma from taking.
"To my notion," Penny said, "if that stranger that come into the doings had knowed it was Oliver's wife, and not just said it were a gal with him, not even Lem would have bothered him. They'd have figured 'twas time to call quits, once that she was married."
"Wife or no wife, it's low-down varmints'll burn a house down figuring somebody's in it."
Penny sighed and was forced to agree. The foresters must be doing their trading at Fort Gates. They never passed. They hadn't picked up their share of the bear meat on their return. Their avoidance of Penny made their guilt incontrovertible. It saddened him. His hard-won peace lay shattered about him. A stone thrown at some distance and meant for someone else had struck him. He was bruised and troubled. Jody was concerned, but it was the anxiety he felt for characters in a tale. Grandma and Oliver and Fluff and Twink had steamed away down the river as people in a book might steam. Oliver became one with the stories he had told of distant places. Now, in the stories, there were Grandma and Twink and Fluff. Oliver had said,
"I'll not forget you, not even in the China Sea."
And it was in the China Sea, for the most part, that he pictured him, infinitely remote and abused by people as fictitious as he. The end of January brought continued warmth. There would be frost, even perhaps a freeze again, before spring truly came. But the balmy days were a harbinger. Penny plowed the fields that would have early crops. He turned the new ground that Buck had cleared for him during his illness from the rattler striking. He'd decided to try a little cotton for a money crop. The low ground near the north hammock would go into tobacco. He prepared his seed beds between the house and the grape arbor. With the stock reduced to Old Caesar and Trixie, he decided to plant cowpeas more sparingly and to put the extra land in corn. There seemed never to be enough. The chickens went short of feed, the hogs were not properly fattened, the Baxters themselves gave out of meal at the end of summer, all for lack of enough corn. Nothing on the clearing was more important. Jody helped him carry the winter's compost from the lot and scatter it over the sandy acres. He planned to have the ground in good condition, bedded up and ready to plant in early March, by the time the first whippoorwill should call. Ma Baxter complained bitterly that she had always wanted a ginger bed. Everyone else had one. The storekeeper's wife at the river had promised her roots any time she was ready for them. Penny and Jody prepared the bed. They dug down 4 feet deep at the side of the house and laid down cypress slats. They hauled clay from the southwest and filled it in. The first time he went trading to the river, Penny promised to bring back the roots, knobby and peaked like antlers. The hunting was poor. The bears were feeding over a wide range, preparing themselves to go in February into hibernation. Their dens were under upturned hurricane stumps or where 2 large logs lay crossed, affording protection. Sometimes they dragged in oak and palmetto limbs and piled them in a hollow tree to make a rough nest. Wherever the bed, it was hollowed out in a trench over the edge of which the bear could rest his forequarters. Jody thought it was strange that they didn't go into their winter beds in December when the first really cold weather came, and then come out earlier in March instead of April. "I reckon they know their own business," Penny said. The deer were distressingly scarce, both because of the plague and the increased voracity of the remaining killers. The bucks were in poor condition, the meat lean, their coats moss gray and shabby. They wandered usually alone. The does traveled alone or in pairs. An old doe traveled with a maiden doe or with her male yearling. Many of the does were already heavy with fawn. The principal work, once the land was turned, was hauling in wood and chopping and splitting it for both fireplaces. Wood, at least, was more easily gotten than ever before, for the storm had brought down large numbers of trees, and the weakening of their roots from the long days of rain and steady wind had toppled still more. Timber had died by the acre in the low places. The effect was as though fire, not flood, had passed through such sections, for the dead trees stood gray and naked. Penny said, "Now I'm proud I live in a high place. He'd fret me having to look at all that bleakness." Jody loved the morning jaunts for wood as well as a hunt. They were leisurely. Penny would hitch Old Caesar at the wagon on a cool, sparkling morning after breakfast, and they would jog one way or another along the road as their fancy took them. The dogs would trot under the wagon and Flag would gallop ahead or to the side. He looked peculiarly wise in his buckskin collar. They would turn off into a clear place in the woods and prowl on foot for a suitable fallen tree, water oak or yellow pine by preference. There was abundant fat pine. This made the hottest and brightest hearth fire and made fine kindling, but it smoked and smuttied the pots and kettles. They would take turns chopping or use the cross-cut saw together. Jody liked the rhythmic swing of the saw, the singing hum as it ate into the wood, the sweet smell of the sawdust sifting to the ground. The dogs nosed nearby in the bushes or ran rabbits. Flag nibbled at the leaf buds or found a succulent sprig of grass that had escaped the frost. Penny always carried his shotgun. Sometimes Julia ran a rabbit within range, or a fox squirrel whisked injudiciously up a nearby pine, and there was pilau for supper. One day, a pure white fox squirrel peered boldly at them, and Penny wouldn't shoot. It was a curiosity, he said, like the albino coon. The meat of old Slewfoot had been coarse and stringy with age, and it took long cooking to tender it. The Baxters had been glad when the last of it was gone. Most of it had been smoked for the dogs, and while it would have been edible in necessity, no one was ever tempted to ask for it. His fat, however, tried out, filled a large wooden bucket. It was as clear and golden as early honey, and was fine for all cooking. The cracklings were as savory as those from a prime hog. There was a double satisfaction whenever any of the Baxters snapped them between their teeth. Ma Baxter spent long hours at her quilting. Penny held Jody to his lessons. The evenings were spent by the hearth fire, blazing brightly to supply light as well as heat. The wind howled cozily around the house. On still nights of moonlight, the foxes could be heard barking in the hammock. Then the lesson stopped, and Penny nodded to Jody, and they listened together. The foxes seldom came to raid the Baxter hen roost.
"They know every hair of Julia's head," Penny chuckled. "They ain't tempting Providence."
One cold, bright night at the end of January, Penny and Ma Baxter had gone to bed while Jody lingered with Flag by the fire. He heard a sound outside in the yard, as though the dogs were scuffling. The commotion was livelier than the pair usually made. He went to the front window and pressed his face to the cold pane. A strange dog was romping with Rip in play. Julia watched tolerantly. He caught his breath. It wasn't a dog. It was a gray wolf, lean and lame. He turned to run and call his father, then, irresistibly drawn, went back to watch again. Wolf and dog had plainly played together before. They weren't strangers. They played silently, as though the dogs kept the secret. Jody went to the door of the bedroom and called softly. Penny came.
"What's the matter, son?"
Jody tiptoed to the window, beckoning. Penny followed on bare feet and looked out where Jody pointed. He whistled under his breath. He made no move for his gun. They watched silently. In the bright moonlight, the motions of the animals were plain. The visitor was crippled in one hip. Its movements were clumsy. Penny whispered,
"Some way pitiful, ain't it? Reckon it's one of them we rounded up that day at the ponds?"
Penny nodded.
"It's almost certain the last one. Poor thing. Hurt and lonesome. Come visitin' its nighest kin to pick a play."
Perhaps the sibilance of their whispers reached beyond the closed window, or their scent drifted to its nose. Soundlessly, it turned and left the dogs, and clambered with difficulty over the fence, and was gone into the night. Jody asked,
"Will it do harm here?"
Penny stretched out his feet to the embers on the hearth.
"I misdoubt it's in shape to catch itself a square meal. I'd not dream of bothering it. A bear'll finish it, or a panther. Leave it live out the rest of its life."
They squatted together by the hearth, caught up in the sadness and the strangeness. It was a harsh thing, even for a wolf, to be so alone that it must turn to the yard of its enemy for companionship. Jody laid an arm across Flag. He wished Flag could understand that he had been spared desolation in the forest. As for himself, Flag had eased a loneliness that had harassed him in the very heart of his family. He saw the lone wolf once again on the waning moon. It never came again. By tacit consent, its visits were not revealed to Ma Baxter. She would have demanded its death, whether or no. Penny believed that the dogs had made its acquaintance on one of their hunts, or perhaps when they were cutting wood, and the dogs had wandered away on their own business. Chapter 29. In February, Penny became badly crippled for a time with his rheumatism. It had bothered him for several years in cold or wet weather. He was careless always about exposure, doing whatever he wished to do, or what seemed necessary, regardless of the weather, and unsparing of himself. It was as good a time as any, Ma Baxter said, for him to be laid up, but he was uneasy for fear he wouldn't be ready for his spring planting.
"Then let Jody do it," she said impatiently.
"He's never done nothing but foller me at it. There's so many things a boy can do wrong at such work as that."
"Yes, and whose fault is it he don't know more about it? You've spared him too long. When you was nearly 13, wasn't you plowing like a man?"
"Yes, and that's just why I don't crave for him to do it till he's got his growth and his strength."
"Oh, butter-hearted," she muttered. "Plowing never hurt nobody."
She pounded poke root and boiled it and made poultices for him and made him a tonic of prickly ash and poke root and potassium. He accepted her ministrations gratefully, but was no better. He went back to his panther oil and rubbed his knees patiently with it an hour at a time and said it helped him more than the other remedies. While his father was idle, Jody did the light chores and kept up with the wood. He had an incentive to hurry at his work, for when it was done, he was free to wander away with Flag. Penny even permitted him to take the shotgun with him. He missed his father's company, yet he liked to hunt alone. He and Flag were free together. They liked best going to the sinkhole. They had stumbled on a game there one day when Flag had gone with him when he went to fetch drinking water. The game was a mad one of tag, up and down the steep slopes of the Great Green Bowl. Flag was unbeatable at it, for he was up and down one side half a dozen times while Jody was making one climb to the top. Finding that he couldn't be caught, he alternated between a teasing business of wearing Jody out and a more satisfying and ingratiating trick of deliberately allowing himself to be captured. On a warm, sunny day in mid-February, Jody looked up from the bottom of the sinkhole. Flag stood in silhouette at the top. For a startled moment, it seemed to him that it was another deer. Flag was so big. He hadn't seen how fast he was growing. Many a young yearling, shot for food, was no bigger than he. He went home to Penny in excitement. Penny sat by the kitchen hearth wrapped in quilts, though the day was mild. Jody burst out,
"Pa, you reckon Flag's near about a yearling?"
Penny looked at him quizzically.
"I've been thinking that myself lately. Give him a month more. I'd say he was a yearling."
"How will he be different?"
"Well, he'll stay off in the woods longer. He'll grow a good bit bigger. He'll be betwixt and between. He'll be like a person standing on the state line. He'll be leaving one and turning into t'other. Behind him's the fawn, before him's the buck."
Jody stared into vacancy.
"Will he have horns?"
"He'll likely not show no horns before July. The bucks are shedding their horns right now. They'll be butt-headed all through spring. Then along in the summer the spikes'll show, and by rutting season they'll have full sets again."
Jody examined Flag's head carefully. He felt the hard edge of his forehead. Ma Baxter passed by with a pan in her hand.
"Hey, Ma, Flag'll soon be a yearling. Won't he be purty, Ma, with little old horns? Won't his horns be purty?"
"He'd not look purty to me did he have a crown on and angel's wings."
He followed her to cajole her. She sat down to look over the dried cowpeas in the pan. He rubbed his nose over the down of her cheek. He liked the furry feel of it.
"Ma, you smell like a roastin' ear in the sun."
"Oh, get along. I've been mixin' cornbread."
"'Tain't that. Listen, Ma, you don't care do Flag have horns or no, do you?"
"It'll be that much more to butt and bother."
He didn't press the point. Flag was an increasing disgrace at best. He had learned to slip free from the halter about his neck. When it was tightened so that he couldn't get out of it, he used the same tactics that a calf used against restraint. He strained against it until his eyes bulged and his breathing choked. And to save his perverse life, it was necessary to release him. Then when he was free, he raised havoc. There was no holding him in the shed. he would have razed it to the ground. He was wild and impudent. He was allowed in the house only when Jody was on hand to keep up with him. But the closed door seemed to make him possessed to enter. If it was not barred, he butted it open. He watched his chance and slipped in to cause some minor damage whenever Ma Baxter's back was turned. She set the dish of shelled dried peas on the table and went to the hearth. Jody went to his room to look for a piece of rawhide. There was a clatter and commotion, and then Ma Baxter's storm of fury. Flag had leaped onto the table, seized a mouthful of the peas, and sent the pan sprawling, the peas scattered from one end of the kitchen to the other. Jody came running. His mother threw the door open and drove Flag out with a broom. He seemed to enjoy the fracas. He kicked up his heels, flicked his white flag of a tail, shook his head as though threatening to attack with imaginary antlers, sailed over the fence, and galloped away to the woods.
Jody said, "That were my fault, Ma. I shouldn't have left him. He were hungry, Ma. The poor feller didn't get enough for breakfast. You should have beat me, Ma, not him. I'll tear down all two of you. Now get down and pick up every one of them peas and wash them off."
He was only too glad to do so. He crawled under the table and reached behind the kitchen safe and under the inside water shelf and in every corner to retrieve them. He washed them carefully and went to the sinkhole for extra water to replace what he had used and more. He felt entirely righteous.
"Now see, Ma," he said, "they's no harm done. Every little harm Flag do, you can depend on me to take care of it."
Flag didn't return until sunset. Jody fed him outside and waited to smuggle him into his bedroom after Penny and Ma were in bed. Flag had lost his fawn's willingness to sleep long hours and had been increasingly restless at night. Ma Baxter had complained that she had heard him tripping about in Jody's room or the front room several times. Jody had invented a plausible tale of rats on the roof, but his mother was skeptical. Perhaps Flag had had a sleep that afternoon in the woods, for this night he left his moss pallet and pushed open the rickety door of Jody's bedroom and wandered about the house. Jody was aroused by a piercing shriek from his mother. Flag had awakened her from a sound sleep by pushing his wet muzzle against her face. Jody slipped the fawn out by the front door before she should do a more thorough job of it.
"Now that ends it," she raged. "That creature gives me no peace day or night. Now he can't come in this house, no time, never no more."
Penny had kept apart from the controversy. Now he spoke from his bed.
"Your ma's right, boy. He's got too big and restless to be in the house."
Jody went back to bed and lay wakeful, wondering if Flag were cold. He thought it was unreasonable of his mother to object to the clean, soft nose against her own. He could never get enough of fondling that delicate muzzle himself. She was a mean, hard woman and didn't care if he was lonely. His resentment eased him, and he went to sleep, clutching his pillow and pretending that it was Flag. The fawn snorted and stamped around the house most of the night. In the morning, Penny felt well enough to dress and hobble around the clearing, leaning on a stick. He made his rounds. He returned to the rear of the house. His face was grave. He called Jody to him. Flag had trampled back and forth across the tobacco seed bed. The young plants were almost ready to set out. He had destroyed nearly half of them. There would be enough for the usual patch for Penny's own use. There would be no money crop, as he had planned, for storekeeper Boyles at Volusia.
"I don't figure Flag done it malicious," he said. "He were just racing back and forth, and it were something to jump on, was all. Now you go set up stakes all through the bed amongst the plants and all around the bed to keep him off'n the rest of 'em. I should have done it before, I reckon, but I never studied on 'em romping in that particular place."
Penny's reasonableness and kindness depressed Jody as his mother's rage had not done. He turned away disconsolately to do the job. Penny said,
"Now, it just being accidental-like, we'll not say nothing to your ma. It'd be a poor time for her to know it."
As Jody worked, he tried to think of a way to keep Flag out of mischief. Most of his tricks he considered only clever, but the destruction of the seedbed was serious. He was sure that such a thing would never happen again. Chapter 30. March came in with a cool and sunny splendor. The yellow jessamine bloomed late and covered the fences and filled the clearing with its sweetness. The peach trees blossomed, and the wild plums. The red birds sang all day, and when they had done with their song in the evening, the mockingbirds continued. The ground doves nested and cooed one to another and walked about the sand of the clearing like shadows bobbing. Penny said, "If I was dead, I'd set up and take notice a day like this'n." There had been a light shower during the night, and the hazy substance of the sunrise indicated there would be another before nightfall. But the morning itself was luminous. "Just right for corn," Penny said. "Just right for cotton. Just right for baccy."
"I take it you're pleased with the day," Ma Baxter said.
He grinned and finished his breakfast.
"Now, just 'cause you feel better," she warned him, "don't get in the field and kill yourself."
"I feel so good," he said. "I'll kill everything keeps me from planting. All day, I'm fixin' to plant all day. Today, tomorrow, the next day, plantin'. Corn, cotton, baccy."
"I heard you," she said.
He stood up and thumped her on the back. "Cowpeas, taters, greens." She had to laugh at him, and Jody laughed too.
"Here, you tell it," she said. "You're fixing to plant the world."
"I'd purely love it." He threw out his arms. "A day like this'n, I'd love to plant rows from here to Boston and back again to Texas. Then, when I come to Texas, I'd turn around and go back to Boston to see if the seeds come up yet."
"I see where Jody gets his fairy tales," she said.
He pounded Jody on the back. "You got a sweet job, boy. You can set out the baccy plants. If my back didn't near about kill me when I stoop, I'd take it from you, for I love setting plants. Little old young green things, giving them a chance to grow." He went whistling to his work. Jody gulped his breakfast and followed him. Penny was at the tobacco seed bed, lifting out the tender plants. "You belong to handle them like they was newborn babies," he said. He set out a dozen plants by way of lesson, then watched and corrected Jody while he went on with the row. He brought old Caesar and the scooter plow and turned to the field, laid off and bedded up ready for the corn, to open the furrows for the planting. Jody hunched along on his heels or dropped to his knees when his legs grew tired. He worked leisurely, for Penny said there was no hurry and that the job must be done well. The March sun grew strong in mid-morning, but a fresh breeze blew. The tobacco plants wilted behind him, but the night's dark coolness would bring them upright again. He watered them as he went and had to go twice to the sinkhole for water. Flag had disappeared after breakfast and wasn't in sight. Jody missed him, but he was relieved that the fawn had chosen the particular morning to stay away. If he joined him and gamboled about as usual, he would destroy the plants faster than Jody could set them out. He finished the task by dinner time. The tobacco patch filled only a portion of the ground that Penny had prepared for it according to the original size of the seed bed. When Penny went with him after dinner to look it over, his father's exuberance ebbed. "You ain't left no plants in the bed, boy? You got 'em all?"
"Every one. I even set them little old spindly ones."
"Well, I'll put in something else to fill out." Jody offered eagerly.
"I can help you with the other planting now, or tote water for you."
"No need to water. It looks more prosperous for a shower every minute. You can help plant." Penny had the furrows open for the corn. Now he went ahead, drilling his holes with a pointed stick down the long rows. Jody followed, dropping two kernels to the hole. He was anxious to please, to have his father forget the shrunken tobacco patch. He called,
"Goes fast, too working, don't it, Paul?"
Penny didn't answer. Yet as the early spring day clouded and the light wind shifted into the southeast, and it was plain that a shower would come on the planting, ensuring the quick sprouting of the corn, his spirits lifted again. The rain caught them in the late afternoon, but they continued to work and finished the field. It rolled gently, well tilled and tawny, its soft bosom receptive to the rain. Leaving it, Penny rested on the split-rail fence and looked back over it with satisfaction. There was a wistful look in his eyes as well, as though he were obliged now to leave his handiwork to forces he could only trust blindly not to betray him. Flag came bounding out of the rain from the south. He came to Jody to be scratched behind the ears. He leaped back and forth in a zigzag across the fence, then stopped under a mulberry tree and reached up to catch the tip of a bough. Jody sat on the fence beside his father. He turned to call Penny's attention to the slim neck of the fawn stretched up to the new green leaves of the mulberry. His father was studying the young deer with an unfathomable expression. His eyes were narrowed and speculative. He seemed, as when he had set out after old Slewfoot, a stranger. A chill passed over the boy that wasn't of the dampness of the rain. He said, "Pa?" Penny turned to him, startled from his thoughts. He looked down, as though to hide a thing in his eyes. He said carelessly, "Now that fawn of yourn sure growed up in a hurry. He ain't the baby you toted home in your arms all the way that black night. He's a yearling now for sure." The words gave Jody little pleasure. Somehow he sensed they weren't quite what his father had been thinking. Penny laid his hand an instant on his son's knee. "You're a pair of yearlings," he said. "It grieves me." They slid from the fence and went to the lot to do the chores, then to the house to dry out by the fire. The rain beat lightly on the shingled roof. Flag bleated outside to be allowed to come in. Jody looked appealingly at his mother, but she was deaf and blind. Penny felt stiff and sat with his back close to the heat, rubbing his knees. Jody begged some stale cornbread and went outside. He made a fresh bed in the shed and enticed Flag inside with the bread. He sat down, and the deer finally doubled its long legs under him and lay down beside him. Jody took hold of the two pointed ears and rubbed his nose against the wet muzzle.
"You a yearling now," he said. "You hear me? You growed up. Now you listen to me. You got to be good now you're growed. You can't go gallivanting across no tobacco. Don't you get Pa down on you. You listening?"
Flag chewed ruminatively.
"All right, then. Now, as soon as we get done with the planting, I can go off with you again. You wait for me. You was gone too long today. Don't you go wild just 'cause I told you you was a yearling."
He left Flag and had the satisfaction of seeing him remain contentedly in the shed. Ma Baxter and Penny had begun supper when he went into the kitchen. They made no comment on his lateness. They ate in silence. Penny went to bed at once. Jody was suddenly tired out and dropped into bed without washing his dusty feet. When his mother came to his door to remind him of it, he was asleep with one arm thrown back over the pillow. She stood looking at him, then turned away without arousing him. In the morning, Penny was blithe again.
"Today's cotton day," he said.
The soft rain had stopped in the night. The morning was dewy. The fields were rosy, dipping into lavender at the far, misty edges. The mockingbirds made a musical din along the fence rows.
"They trying to hurry the mulberries," Penny said.
The cotton was sowed free in drills. Later, it would be chopped out to a stand a foot apart with the hoe. Jody followed his father as before, dropping the small, shining seeds. He was curious about the new Baxter crop and asked endless questions. Flag had disappeared shortly after breakfast, but came trotting to the planters in mid-morning. Again, Penny watched him. His sharp hooves cut deeply into the soft, moist earth. But the seeds were planted deeply enough so that no harm was possible.
"He do take out after you and he misses you," Penny said.
"He's like a dog that-a-way, ain't he, Pa? He wants to tag me just like Julia tags you."
"You think a heap of him, don't you, boy?"
"Why, sure."
He stared at his father. Penny said,
"Well,
We'll wait and see. The remark made no particular sense, and Jody ignored it. The planting continued all week. Cowpeas followed the corn and cotton. Sweet potatoes followed the cowpeas. The vegetable garden back of the house was planted to onions and turnips, for the moon was dark, and root crops must be planted then. Penny had been forced by his rheumatism to let pass the 14th of February, the date on which collards should be planted, so as not to go to seed. He was tempted to put them in now, but since the leafy crops did best when planted on an increasing moon, he decided to wait a week or so. He was up early each day and finished late. He drove himself mercilessly. The planting itself was done, but he wasn't content. He was in a fever over the spring work, for weather conditions were favorable and the year's living depended on the immediate results. He carried the two heavy buckets full of water from the sinkhole again and again to water the tobacco plants in the garden. A stump that Buck Forrester had left to rot out in the new ground where the cotton was planted annoyed him. He dug and chopped around it, then hooked trace chains to it and put old Caesar at pulling on it. The old horse tugged and strained, his sides heaving. Penny lashed a rope about the stump, said, "Gee up," to Caesar, and pulled with him. Jody saw his father's face turn white. Penny clutched at his groin and sank to his knees. Jody ran to him.
"It's all right. I'll be all right in a minute. Reckon I strained myself."
He dropped to the ground and stirred in agony. He murmured,
"I'll be all right. Go put Caesar up. Wait. Take a hold of my hand. I'll ride him in."
He was bent double and couldn't straighten for pain. Jody helped him to the stump. From there he managed to clamber on Caesar's back. He leaned forward, resting his head on Caesar's neck, gripping the mane. Jody unhitched the trace chains and led the horse out of the field and through the gate into the yard. Penny made no move to get down. Jody brought a chair for him to stand on, to break the descent. Penny slid to it and to the ground and crept into the house. Ma Baxter turned from her work at the kitchen table. She dropped a pan with a clatter.
"I knowed it. You've hurt it yourself. You don't never know to quit."
He shuffled to his bed and threw himself face down on it. She followed and turned him over and put a pillow under his head. She pulled off his shoes and laid a light quilt over him. He stretched out his legs with relief. He closed his eyes.
"That's good. Oh, Ori, that's good. I'll be all right in a minute. Must have strained myself."
Chapter 31. Penny did not recover. He lay suffering without complaint. Ma Baxter wanted Jody to ride for Doc Wilson, but Penny wouldn't allow it.
"I owe him already," he said. "I'll get easement directly."
"You're likely ruptured."
"Even so, it'll clear up,"
Ma Baxter lamented.
"If you had a mite of sense, but you'll try to do like as if you was big as a forester."
"My Uncle Miles were a big man, and he were ruptured. He got around all right. Please to hush, Ori."
"I'll not hush. I want you should learn your lesson and learn it good."
"I've done learned it. Please hush."
Jody was disturbed. Yet Penny was always having minor accidents, trying with his small, stout physique to do the work of 10. Jody could remember dimly when a tree that Penny was felling had caught him, crushing one shoulder. His father had carried his arm in a sling for long months, but he had recovered and been as strong as ever. Nothing could harm Penny for long. Not even a rattlesnake, he thought comfortingly, could kill him. Penny was inviolable, as the earth was inviolable. Only Ma Baxter fretted and fumed, but she would have done so if it were only a little finger that had been strained. Shortly after Penny was laid up, Jody came in to report that the corn was up. The stand was perfect.
"Now, ain't that fine?" The pale face on the pillow was bright. "Now, if it so happen I ain't out in the bed,
You're just a feller to plow it up. He frowned. Boy, you know as good as I do, you got to keep that yearling out in the fields.
I'll keep him out. He ain't bothered nary thing.
That's fine. That's just fine. But you keep him out religious.
Jody spent most of the next day on a hunt with Flag. They went nearly to Juniper Spring and returned with 4 squirrels. Penny said,
Now that's what I call a son. Come in with rations for his old man.
Ma Baxter made a pilau of the squirrels for supper.
They do eat good, she said.
Why, the meat's so tender, Penny said. You could kiss it off the bones.
Jody and Flag with him was in high favor. A light rain fell in the night. In the morning, he went to the cornfield at Penny's request to see whether the rain had pushed the corn and whether there was any sign of cutworms. He'd leaped the split rail fence and set out across the field. He'd gone some yards when it occurred to him that he should be seeing the pale green shoots of the corn. There were none. He was bewildered. He went farther. There was no corn visible. It was not until he reached the far end of the field that the delicate sprouts appeared. He walked back along the rows. Flag's sharp tracks were plain. He had pulled up the corn in the early morning as neatly as though it had been pulled by hand. Jody was frightened. He dawdled about the field, hoping to have a miracle happen and the corn appear again when his back was turned. Perhaps he was having a nightmare in which Flag had eaten the corn crop, and when he awakened, he would go out and find it growing, green and tender. He pushed a stick into one arm to make sure. The dull misery he felt was that of a bad dream, but the pain in his arm was as real as the destruction of the corn. He dragged back to the house with slow and heavy feet. He sat down in the kitchen and didn't go to his father. Penny called him. He went to the bedroom.
Well, boy, how's the crops?
The cotton's up. It looks like okra, don't it?
His enthusiasm was spurious.
The cowpeas is breaking the ground.
He spread the toes of his bare feet and wriggled them. He was absorbed in them, as though they had developed an interesting new function.
And the corn, Jody.
His heart beat as fast as a hummingbird's wings. He swallowed and took the plunge.
Something's ed off most of it.
Penny lay silent. His silence was a nightmare, too. At last he spoke.
Couldn't you tell what 'twas done it?
He looked at his father. His eyes were desperate and beseeching. Penny said,
Nah, mind. I'll get your ma to go look. She can tell.
Don't send ma.
She's obliged to know.
Don't send her.
Hit were Flag done it, wasn't it?
Jody's lips trembled.
I reckon. Yes, sir.
Penny looked at him pityingly.
I'm sorry, boy. I more'n half looked for him to do it. You go play a while. Tell your ma to come here.
Don't tell her, Pa. Please, don't tell her.
She's got to know, Jody. Now go on. I aim to do the best I can for you.
He stumbled to the kitchen.
Pa wants you, Ma.
He went out of the house. He called Flag quaveringly. The deer came to him from the blackjack. Jody walked down the road with his arm across his back. He loved him more than ever in his sin. Flag kicked up his heels and invited him to romp. He had no heart for play. He walked slowly as far as the sinkhole. It was lovely as a spring flower garden. The dogwood had not finished blooming. The last blossoms were white against the pale green of the sweet gums and the hickories. He was not even tempted to walk around it. He turned back to the house and went inside. His mother and father were still talking. Penny called to him to come in beside the bed. Ma Baxter's face was flushed. She was hot with defeat. Her mouth was a tight line. Penny said quietly.
We've come to an agreement, Jody. What's happened is powerful bad. But we'll have a try at a remedy. I take it you're willing to work extra hard to fix things.
I just do.